Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week, we come to an end to our 40-week series in the book of Exodus. Pastor Jeremy brings us a message that brings us full circle back around to Jesus. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Jeremy.
So, good morning, South Harbor. My name is Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here, and today's kind of a big day for us. If you've been here for a while at South, today is week 40 of a 40-week series we've been in the book of Exodus. I can remember back to about a year ago when Tim and I, we were kind of parsing out the series and what would it look like for us to deep dive the book of Exodus and what are the stories you're going to hit? How are we going to go through the book of Exodus? And so we sat down with a document and we kind of worked it through. And at the end, we looked at each other and went, oh, we ended on 40 weeks, which feels like a good biblical Exodus number. And so we decided, let's go for it. And so we are here on week 40 of 40 weeks through the book of Exodus. And so today is going to be kind of similar to the last couple weeks, where we've really been kind of asking the question, how does the story of Exodus help us understand the story of Jesus? How does what we've done for the last 39 weeks help us understand more of our New Testament stories of who Jesus is? And so we're going to kind of back our way into the book of Exodus again, starting in a New Testament story with the story of Jesus. So if you want to follow along, we will be in Matthew chapter 17 this morning. We will put all the words on the screen. Matthew chapter 17. So let's go ahead and start reading at verse 1. It says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and he led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then, there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. When they looked up, they saw no one there except Jesus. It's a story we call the Transfiguration. And can we just name on the front end, like, it's a weird story, isn't it? Like, it's a weird story. You notice there's a handful of details in the story that I find, in a weird story, I found particularly odd. One, you notice the whole thing about, like, Jesus is glowing, right? Like, why in the world is Jesus glowing? And then in the story, like, you notice all of a sudden, like, there's this, like, poof, and other people show up. Right? Like, it's Jesus and the disciples. All of a sudden, there's like a poof, and now there's Moses and Elijah, and all of a sudden, they're there? Like Jesus is just working some weird magic trick? Like, anybody old enough to remember, like, David Copperfield back in the day? Anybody? I can remember, like, oh, we got a woot for David Copperfield. I love it. I can remember, like, elementary school, like, my family gathering in the living room and watching him make the Statue of Liberty disappear, and, like, my 10-year-old mind melted, right? Is that what Jesus is doing? Like, hey, guys, check out what I can do. Moses and Elijah, and then, boom, they're gone. What is going on with Moses and Elijah? And then there's the whole thing of, like, Jesus is like a human light stick. Like, we crack him and he glows. Like, what is going on with Jesus glowing? And then you notice the thing about Peter's response, right? Like, Peter's up there. Jesus is glowing. Like, Elijah and Moses show up. And you notice Peter's response. Peter says, hey, I got a Coleman in my backpack, right? Like, what if I build shelters? Like, what is that for a response? Peter wants to just like, hey, let's camp. Like, we can build a fire. Like, we can hang out. What is Peter doing with the response? Like, one, maybe Peter's just this like super entrepreneur, and like Peter realizes like if he sets up like the world's first Airbnb, right? Like he sets up like, do you know how much people would pay to stay in the Jesus tent? And then the question of the tents, why does Peter suggest they should build three of them? Like Jesus is God, he has to sleep well, right? But like, does Moses snore? Like Elijah's the 12-year-old that sleeps sideways in the bed. You can't share a tent with Elijah. Like, why does Peter want to build three tents? And then there's still the question of like, why in that moment does Jesus like have this like Gandalf the Gray to Gandalf the White moment, right? Like he's what is happening in the story? What is going on? And then the question of what does it matter for any of us, right? Jesus is glowing, Moses and Elijah show up. How does that help us when the reality is we show up here carrying a number of things through the doors, right? For those of us who walk into this space asking the big questions of like, where is God, especially when life gets hard? Right? Like, where is God, especially in those moments where life doesn't make sense? There's the expectations you had of like what faith would look like, what life would look like, and the reality is you're sitting here and the spaces you're sitting in don't look like the spaces you expected. For some of us, like, you stood on a stage in front of your family and friends, and you made promises, and you had all of these dreams of what life would look like. And for some of us, we're sitting in spaces where life doesn't look like we did. How does this story help us? So I want to spend the next chunk of time. This is going to be one of those, like, we're going to have to dive in and do some work today. We okay with that? We trust God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. So we're going to do some of that today. But I want to start, maybe let's start by looking back at Peter's statement, right? Peter, in this moment, Peter has this like, let's build tents. Now, I think there's a couple ways we can respond to Peter in this moment, aren't there? Like, on the one hand, we can go to what I've often heard. I've heard this sermon preached a number of times, this passage preached. And typically the thing about Peter is just, we're going to throw him under the bus, right? Peter has no idea what he's talking about. There's this thing going on. And what Peter offers is absolutely ridiculous. What is Peter thinking? We are so much smarter than Peter, right? Oh, Peter, and you roll your eyes and you throw him under the bus. But I wonder, if we do a little bit of work and dive into the story, what if maybe Peter's onto something? Maybe, what if maybe Peter is seeing what's happening on the mountain, and Peter is recalling something, he's remembering something. What if Peter, a good religious Jewish disciple of Jesus, just maybe knows his Bible better than we do, and what if his response actually makes a whole lot of sense? So what I want to do is jump into, if you're Peter, and you're in this moment, Jesus on the mountain, Moses and Elijah show up. If you're Peter, what might be running through your head? Is it possible you're remembering the stories of the two people who just showed up on the mountain? Does that feel reasonable? I grew up a giant fan of Michael Jordan. Anybody else like big Michael Jordan fans? I can't see Michael Jordan without immediately, like, it's middle school me watching the guy just shred a basketball court. Is it possible for Peter, like, Moses and Elijah are those people to him? It makes sense to me that if Peter's on a mountain, he sees Moses and Elijah, all of a sudden Peter is now remembering the stories of Moses and Elijah, and just maybe one of those stories, or both of those stories, is going to help him make sense of what's going on there. So what I want to do is I want to jump into one of those stories. It's in the book of Exodus. You're now experts in the book of Exodus, right? So in the book of Exodus, another story that I want to make a case this morning is running through Peter's head when he's standing on that mountain. So if we jump to Exodus 24, we read this story. We're going to pay attention to a few details. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. you are to worship at a distance, but Moses alone is to approach the Lord. The others may not come near, and the people may not come up with him. Okay, question. Moses is being invited to meet God. How many people is Moses told to take along? Like, you've got the 70 elders. They have to stay at a distance, but who specifically, how many people is he specifically told to bring? Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu. Three people. Okay, so Moses is invited by God to come and bring three people with him. Let's continue the story. When Moses went up on the, where are they going? A mountain. The cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai for how long?
6 days.
6 days, the cloud covered the mountain, and on the seventh day, the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. To the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. Okay, Moses is told to bring three people to go up a mountain. When Moses goes up the mountain, the glory of God is going to settle on top of the mountain in a cloud for how long? 6 days. And then we read this 10 chapters later in still that same story. In Exodus 34, it says, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, and what happens on the mountain is God will speak and God will give Moses the law. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses and his face was radiant and they were afraid to come near him, but Moses called to them. So Aaron and all the leaders of the community came back to him and he spoke to them. Afterwards, all the Israelites came near him and he gave them all the commands the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking to them, he put a veil over his face. Okay, so a story, Peter's remembering. Moses told to bring three people up a mountain. The glory of God is going to settle on the mountain in a cloud for 6 days. God is going to speak to Moses on this mountain. Moses is then going to come down and his face is radiant. Anybody have any hold on. Anybody, the light bulbs are start going on of what Peter might be seeing in his story. Let's jump back into the transfiguration, the story we started with. After how many days? Okay, that could be coincidence, right? Just the first. So after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. How many people does Jesus bring? So we have 6 days. We have Jesus bringing three people, and where does he bring them? A high mountain. Now, this is going to be a different mountain, at least, than the Moses story. Moses would have climbed Mount Sinai. That's a possibility. We don't know exactly where Mount Sinai is. It's a possibility. Jesus is not bringing his disciples up Mount Sinai. Jesus is bringing his disciples up what Matthew just calls is a high mountain. Matthew doesn't really give us the detail, but if you've been here for any amount of time, you know that we believe that the geography, that the locations actually matter, that geography is more than just kind of the backdrop of where the stories happen, but geography in a lot of ways actually plays as almost similar. I often say that geography plays as a character in the story, where often the geography gives us something important. And so you probably won't be surprised that we have an opinion of what mountain Jesus is going to bring his disciples up. It's not Sinai, but it's another mountain. In order to show you, we want to go to a map. So this is kind of map of Israel. I'm going to use my fancy laser pointer. You've got Sea of Galilee. You've got Dead Sea down here. I want to make a case this morning that the high mountain Jesus brings his disciples on is going to be in this region. So if we zoom in, you'll notice you got the Sea of Galilee down here. Can you already see in the kind of topography of the map, this area looks different? This area is going to be the largest mountain in all of Israel. It's the mountain of Mount Hermon. So why do I think Jesus brings his disciples up that mountain? Well, there's three big cases I want to make this morning. One is the story that happens right before. So we read out of Matthew 17, If we back up just a handful of verses into Matthew 16, what we find is Jesus. So Jesus lives in the north part of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus in Matthew 16 is going to bring his disciples low to mid 30-mile walk. So it's a big day's walk, maybe 2 days walk north into the region of Caesarea Philippi. This is Caesarea Philippi. It's essentially Caesarea Philippi exists on the base of Mount Hermon. If we actually take a picture, an aerial shot, you'll notice the giant mountain, Mount Hermon. This little kind of city down here, that is Caesarea Philippi. So Matthew 16, Jesus brings his disciples here at the base of Mount Hermon, where I'm going to argue he was in Matthew chapter 17. We follow so far. The Caesarea Philippi story in Matthew 16, why Jesus brings his disciples there, has a lot to do, with one of the cliff faces on Mount Hermon today looks like this. So you notice on the left side, you've got a cave. On the right side, you have a whole bunch of like archaeological remains. If we put a photo of kind of the first century edition, this, do you see the cave behind the temple? Same cave we saw in that last picture. This is a temple to the Caesar. This is a temple to Apollo. This is why Caesarea Philippi in Jesus' day was a super important, well-known city. This is where you would have worshipped, it's a whole other sermon, this Greco-Roman god by the name of Pan. You would have worshipped Pan here. This area, I kid you not, was called the dance floor of the sacred goats. Legitimately, the dance, but that is its own sermon. That's a big sermon. So Jesus brings his disciples to a cliff face, a city on the base of Mount Hermon, where they are worshiping the Caesar, they're worshiping Apollo, they're worshiping this Greco-Roman god Pan. Pan was a fertility god. He was depicted as half human, half goat. There's that. So all of this stuff is happening at the base of Mount Hermon, and Jesus brings his disciples there. You might remember the story of why Jesus brings his disciples there. He goes to essentially the worst place in his world to ask his disciples a question. Hey, who do people say that I am? What's the word on the street, right? Who do people say that I am? And his disciples will respond. His disciples will say, oh, well, some say you're John the Baptist. Others say Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. And then Jesus will turn the question on them. Who do you say that I am, Jesus says. And then Simon Peter speaks up, because Simon Peter's always the first to speak up, right? Like, we could roll our eyes and throw Peter under the bus, but likely Peter is the oldest. In Jesus' day, it wasn't uncommon for a rabbi to have an older disciple and a much younger disciple, and the rest of the disciples kind of fall in between. Peter is likely the older one. He's the one that's often expected to speak up. John is likely the youngest one. It's why when Jesus is being crucified, the only disciple still there is John, and Jesus has that whole moment with his mom, like, Mary, this is now your son, making sure somebody's going to take care of John. Peter's probably the oldest. Peter speaks up. Peter says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It's this pivotal moment. It's the first time, like, they get Jesus for who he is, but what they don't yet get is what that's going to mean, what Jesus is going to do, what it's going to mean that Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus will actually tell them in what's next. It says, from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. They recognize he's the Messiah. Jesus says, yes, you got it. And what that's going to mean is I'm going to suffer, I'm going to be arrested, I'm going to be in, and I'm going to be killed. And his disciples cannot wrap their minds around it. To them, the Messiah was going to come and sit on a throne. He's going to rule. Like, his kingdom is going to reign, and it's going to happen now. What they couldn't wrap their minds around was that Jesus was going to come as the Messiah, as the king, but what that meant is he was going to lay his life down and he was going to die. This is that moment when Peter actually rebukes him and Jesus does the whole get behind me, Satan bit. But Jesus brings them to the base of Mount Hermon in Matthew 16, where all of this idol worship is happening, so that they can see who he really is. So back to Mount Hermon. Why here? Because the story that happens right before happens right there. That's case number one. Case number two, Tim and I, we've had the opportunity to lead some trips over to Israel over the last number of years, and we became really good friends with, his name's Ronen Ben Moshe. He's our Israeli guide. He lives in the suburbs of Jerusalem. If you know him, you love him. But Ronen will say that in Israel, if you're in Israel and you're going to reference the river, everybody knows what river you're talking about. If you name the river in Israel, what river are you talking about? The Jordan. He said, if you talk about the city, everybody knows what city you're talking about. You talk about the city in Israel, you're talking about Jerusalem. He says, if you talk about the mountain in Israel, everyone knows what mountain you're talking about. You're talking about the largest mountain in all of Israel. You're talking about Mount Hermon. So that's case number two. Case number three, the word Mount Hermon, if you actually translate it, simply means holy mountain. If Jesus is going to bring his disciples to a mountain to be transfigured in front of them, I think it makes sense that it's the holy mountain that exists right next to the place that he just was. So, back to our story. We good on that? Do we agree? Yes. Job well done. Okay. Jesus. 6 days. After 6 days, Jesus will invite three people, Peter, James, and John, and then they will go up on the mountain, and then we read this. There, he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then, there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. So again, put yourself in Peter's shoes. You have 6 days. You have Jesus bringing three people onto a mountain. We're going to see that the glory of God is going to descend on the mountain in a cloud. We have Jesus' face is shining. Can you see that if you're Peter, you've got all of those, like the blinky lights on your dashboard of your brain, right, are all going off, right? Peter's going, I've seen this before. Moses took three people in 6 days, and the glory of God settling on the top of a mountain in a cloud, and Moses' face shining, and then Peter knows what comes next. So if you put your kind of like Exodus memory hats on, we go back to Mount Sinai. Moses goes up. He's the clouds there for 6 days. His three people. God shows up. God speaks. Moses' face shines. Do you remember what happens after Mount Sinai? Anybody remember what happens after Mount Sinai? It's a couple things. He's going to come down, and he's going to find that the people have been doing something while he was gone. Right? They build this golden calf, and so you have some idol worship happening now at the base of the mountain that he goes up and has this encounter with God. But anybody remember when Moses is on the mountain, he's given the law, so he's given like the Ten Commandments and more than the Ten Commandments, but he's also given instructions about how to build something. What instructions is he given? The instructions to build the tabernacle. And if we show a picture of the tabernacle, what is the tabernacle? It's a tent. It's a shelter. So Peter knows that Moses goes up on the mountain. All of this 6 days, three people, glory of God descending on the mountain. God is going to speak. Moses' face is going to shine. And the thing that comes next is they're going to build a shelter, a tent, where the presence of God is now going to dwell. And so Peter is watching it all happen again. It's 6 days, three people. Jesus goes up on a mountain. The glory of God settles in this cloud. Jesus is shining. And so Peter goes, hey, tell you what, I know what we should do. And so Peter says in the next verse, says, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up three shelters. That word shelter in the Greek, anybody, any guesses how else we could translate that? It's the same word for tabernacle. Peter sees it. He gets it. He knows that in front of him, literally the story of the Exodus, the story of Moses is playing out again, that Jesus is entering into the story. But Jesus isn't just entering the story. Jesus is in this place bringing the story further. We read the response. It says, while he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud, so God speaking, said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." And now, we could do a whole sermon on just that statement. God, in that statement, is actually quoting from three parts of their Old Testament. The Hebrew Old Testament is kind of broken into three different categories. God is actually like picking a statement out of all three and then bringing them together. But there's one of the pieces that God is quoting I want to look at. It's that last piece where God says, "Listen to him." Any guess in the context of the story, who might God be quoting? Moses. Of course he's quoting Moses. Moses, in the book of Deuteronomy, essentially gives a sermon to the people before they cross into the promised land. And in Moses' sermon, he says this. He says, "The Lord, your God, will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him. The Lord said to me, 'What they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their fellow Israelites. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command them.'" Moses in Deuteronomy said, God will raise up another one like me who will be more than me, who will be bigger than me. The Jewish people would take that promise in Deuteronomy and recognize that what Moses was saying, whether he knew it or not, that God would fulfill that when God sends the Messiah, the King, the promised one. And so in this moment, when the story of Moses are largely being reenacted, God quoting Moses about the prophecy, about the one who's to come, is essentially saying the one that Moses talked about, he's here and this is him. That in this moment, Jesus is stepping into the story, but he's also bringing the story further. I wish we had another 35 minutes to also look at parallels with the story of Elijah, but just a quick kind of flyover overview of the story of Elijah, because Moses represents, to the Hebrew people, Moses represents the law. Elijah represents the prophets. And so in this moment, Moses shows up, Elijah shows up. Essentially, Matthew wants us to see that Jesus is stepping into the story of the scriptures of the Old Testament, and he's bringing it somewhere new. He's bringing it further. That Moses had his encounter on top of a mountain. Elijah has kind of a couple moments, encounters with God on top of a mountain. One of them will be on the same mountain that Moses was on. The other that I want to highlight is on this mountain. This is not Mount Sinai. It's not Mount Hermon. This is Mount Carmel. And in the story, just a real quick kind of Cliff Notes version, Elijah is going to go up on Mount Carmel because there's a whole bunch of pagan gods being worshipped. It's not the golden calf of Exodus. It's not Pan and Caesar and Apollo of Jesus. There's a bunch of people who are worshipping Baal. And Elijah stands up and says, "Tell you what, let's go ahead and do this like showdown. I'm going to build an altar to God. You prophets of Baal, you build an altar to Baal, and then we're going to ask God to send fire to light the sacrifice that we put on an altar." And so they do it. They rock, paper, scissors for who goes first. I have no idea how they decided who goes first. But the prophets of Baal went first. And so they built their altar. They put the sacrifice on the altar, and they did all kinds of ridiculous things to try to get Baal to send fire to burn up the offering. Does fire come? No fire. It's Elijah's turn. Elijah builds his altar. Elijah puts his sacrifice on top of the altar, and then he doesn't just pray. He first has people bring water to dump on top of the altar, not once, not twice, but three times. Water is dumped on the altar. Elijah then prays for God to send fire. God in the story will send so much fire, it'll consume the sacrifice, the altar itself, and all of the water on the ground. Elijah wins, right? This encounter with God on top of a mountain. Anybody remember, any guesses what they do with the prophets of Baal after Elijah has this experience with God on top of a mountain? They all get slaughtered. Elijah afterwards goes up, experience with God, all of the prophets of Baal get slaughtered. I remember the Moses story. Moses goes up. He has his encounter with God on top of a mountain. At the base of the mountain are a bunch of people worshiping a golden calf. Moses will come down. What happens to people who are worshiping a golden calf? Slaughtered. Both of them, they go up, encounter experience with God. They come down. Moses essentially orders the death of all those worshiping the golden calf. Elijah will essentially order the death of all those who are worshiping Baal. Jesus now, stepping into the story, bringing the story further, showing us what God actually looks like. And then the story of Matthew 17 ends this way. When the disciples heard this, God speaking out of the cloud, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. So it ends with them being blown away. Jesus, they see, is stepping into the story and bringing it further. But then my kind of PS, because the Transfiguration story ends there. But the book of Matthew doesn't end there. And Jesus is going to come down from the mountain, and he's going to have this encounter with a father and son that, if I'm honest, for a long time always felt strange to me. It felt odd. It felt out of place. If I'm honest, we'll look at it in a minute. In the story, Jesus almost feels like he's exceptionally harsh, I think, in the story. I didn't love the story, but now I want to suggest that when we read it in light of this story, Jesus is actually doing something brilliant. So they have this encounter on the mountain. Jesus comes up, encounter with God comes down, and we read this. It says, when they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. "Lord, have mercy on my son," he said. "He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water." Okay, quick pause. Now, we're going to find out in a minute that the boy, there's something demonic happening with the boy. And so the details, fire and water, though, stick out to me. And so I want to kind of a Jeremy wonders, right? So what comes in the next, like, 3 minutes? Just flag, like, categorize it in your brain as a Jeremy wonders if. On the one hand, fire and water could represent something about the demonic thing that's happening. That could make sense. I think there's evidence of that through the rest of the scriptures. But I wonder if it's not also trying to link back to the two people that Jesus just encountered on Mount Hermon. Okay, wonder with me. Story of Moses. Does water show up in the story of Moses? Yeah, it's a pivotal part of Moses, right? They cross the sea, they cross the water into the desert. Fire shows up all over the place. God's presence shows up in fire. Elijah's whole story, if we backed it up even a little bit further, the reason he has the showdown with the prophets of Baal is because there's a drought. There is no water. Elijah will then challenge the prophets of Baal. He will then dump water all over his altar. God will then show up in fire. I wonder if there's something linking the two together, and especially because of what comes next. So it says this, the father, speaking about his son, says, "I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him." "You unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy here to me." Jesus rebuked the demon. He came out of the boy, and he was healed at that very moment. Can we name Jesus' response? Feels harsh, doesn't it? This dad just wants his son to be healed, brings him to him, says, "Everybody's tried, and nobody's been able to do it. And my son he's continuing to suffer. Jesus, will you do something?" And Jesus responds with, like, "You evil and perverse generation." How that feels harsh from Jesus, doesn't it? So either Jesus is just like, he's had it, he's fed up, he's tried to teach them all these things and they just don't see it and he's frustrated. Or maybe Jesus is doing something. Maybe Jesus is using it to teach them something. See, I have this belief that when Jesus is doing his healings, when he's doing his miracles, Jesus isn't just like David Copperfield experiencing through the world, right? But Jesus' healings and his miracles are all there to teach his disciples something. Jesus is doing something intentional. So maybe Jesus is doing something here, and maybe we dive into Jesus' response and realize that what Jesus is doing is quoting somebody else. Any guesses in the context of the story who Jesus might be quoting? Moses. Jesus is again quoting Moses. Moses in the book of Deuteronomy, there's this weird spot right in the kind of end of the book of Deuteronomy where it says like, Moses then sang this song to the people. Like, Moses was a lot of things. Soloist was never on my bingo card, right? But apparently he was. So Moses sings this song in its entirety to the people. And he says, he's talking about God. He is the rock. His works are perfect and all his ways are just. A faithful God who does no wrong, upright and just is he. They, the people, are corrupt and not his children. To their shame, they're a warped and a crooked generation. Jesus is going to enter into the story and he's going to bring it further. Because remember the story of Moses. Moses goes up his mountain on Mount Sinai, has this encounter with God, comes down, sees all of the people worshiping this golden calf and orders the execution of everybody there. Elijah is going to go up on his mountain on Mount Carmel, have this experience on the top of Mount Carmel, and at the end of it, everybody worshiping Baal are executed. Jesus is going to go up his mountain, have an experience with God. Remember, what's happening at the base of the mountain? All of this pagan idol worship, Jesus is going to come down and Jesus is going to do something different. The story of Jesus does not end in death and destruction and wiping out all of them. The story of Jesus ends with a boy being set free, his life being restored, and his future being given back to him. That Jesus is using the stories they knew to step into them, to bring them further, and to show them who God really is, what God really looks like. And I think that the disciples needed that moment on the mountain, watching Jesus step into the story, watching his face shine, because of that thing they could never wrap their minds around, because of what Jesus knew was going to come to him. That Jesus knew that there would be a time, not too long from then, when Jesus was going to go up another mountain. Not Mount Hermon, but Jesus, one Passover one year, is going to go up another mountain, a mountain we know that, a mountain that has the city right on top of it, right? He's gonna travel into Jerusalem. And that year, Jesus is going to climb that mountain, and it's going to look very different than the Mountain of Transfiguration. That Jesus is going to go up the mountain in Jerusalem where he will be arrested. He's going to be beaten. He's going to be killed. And I think Jesus knew in order for his disciples to understand what was happening on that hill, they needed to see him first on this hill. Because on this hill, Jesus goes up this holy mountain. That hill, Jesus is going to go up a hill that Matthew calls the place of the skull. That this time, in the story of the Transfiguration, Jesus is going to go up with his three disciples. At the crucifixion, Jesus is going to be one of three with a criminal on his right and his left. That at the Transfiguration, Jesus is going to go up to the top of the hill and there's going to be this bright light. In the crucifixion, there is no light, but darkness is going to cover the face of the earth. In the transfiguration, God is going to speak, "This is my son whom I love." At the crucifixion, God is silent. Jesus is crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" At the transfiguration, the disciples are all present and they're fallen. The disciples that are present are fallen down in awe. At the crucifixion, the disciples have largely all scattered. There's only one that remains. I think what Jesus knew is that if his disciples had not seen him in his glory, had not seen him for who he is, the threat is the crucifixion might look like a loss of everything they'd hoped for. The crucifixion might look like a defeat. The crucifixion might look to them like we thought he was somebody, we must have been wrong, we must now have to wait for somebody else. But because they saw him on the mountaintop, they knew this was no longer a defeat of the plan, this was always part of the plan. They needed the transfiguration in order to understand the crucifixion. See, I think for the disciples, the mountaintop moment of the transfiguration didn't get wiped away, didn't get erased by the darkness of the crucifixion, but it became the anchor, one of the things they could anchor themselves to, that when life didn't look like they expected, when the story didn't end the way they had hoped, they'd expected, they'd wanted, they still had something they could anchor their faith and their hopes to, knowing who Jesus actually is and what he came to do. See, it's one of my hopes that for us, we might learn what the disciples learned, right? That those mountaintop experiences, those moments when, like, God feels real and he feels present and he feels close, that I think one of the threats is those things, I think, often are threatened to be, like, erased by the times when it doesn't go as we'd expected, when it didn't go as we'd hoped, when our dreams don't come true. But I think one of the hopes is that we might learn what the disciples learned on that mountain, that those moments don't get erased by the valleys in life, but they become anchors that we can hold on to. That even when we go through the difficult seasons in life, we can anchor ourselves to knowing who God is, to knowing that God is here, that God is present, and that God is, in fact, as the disciples discovered, still good and still working on our behalf. Would you pray with me? God, for this story, for the story of the Exodus and the way this story helps us understand more fully who you are, that you are a God who came to seek and to save all those who are lost, regardless of how lost we might be. God, for the way that you, Jesus, came here to show us the truth of who you are, that you are a God who truly loves and welcomes each and every one of us with open arms. God, we are grateful. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So this morning, we get to remember that second hill, that hill that Jesus is going to be crucified on, because this morning, we get to gather around the table for communion, that we remember that on the night when Jesus was betrayed, he was going to first gather with his disciples. They would share what we know as the Passover meal, and during the meal, Jesus would raise the bread. He would raise it and he would break it. And Jesus would say, "This is my body broken for you. Do this as often as you eat of it, remembering me." And then after they'd eaten, he took the cup. And as he poured the cup, he said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink of it, remembering me." And so in just a few moments, we're going to be invited to come forward and to remember the sacrifice of Jesus through the breaking of the bread and the pouring of the cup and a little bit of how we do communion here at South Harbor.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org. Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 10 a.m. on both Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church and the Harbor Churches, we want to once again wish you a blessed week.